So we're continuing this morning with our series on the book of Esther. And here in chapter 3, the story takes a very dark and ominous turn. The empire, the Persian Empire, indulgent, we've seen, opulent, comical, excessive to the point of parody, now becomes dangerous and threatening. And we'll make 3 points. They're there on the outline in your bulletin. The refusal, the rage, the royal decree. The refusal, the rage, the royal decree. So first then, the refusals. Chapter 3 of the book of Esther opens with the words, after these things. Meaning after, and we saw this a couple weeks ago, 2 weeks ago. After Mordecai saved the king's life by foiling an assassination plot. After those things. Remember, he had told the new queen, Esther, and she told the king, explicitly giving credit to Mordecai. That's what happened at the end of chapter 2. So when we read, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted, we expect it to be Mordecai's name that we hear right there. But it is not. He honored one Haman, introduced now into the story for the first time. And Mordecai goes unrewarded. He suffers the slight, the injustice of being forgotten, being ignored for his good deeds and his work. Many of you, I'm sure, have experienced this, being passed over or being ignored while someone else is promoted. Life in general and life in the empire particularly is unfair. Not only is it unfair, it's often irrational. Right? Frequently, people get what they don't deserve, or they don't get what they do deserve. It's a common feature of human existence in the fallen world. No fewer than 18 officials or counselors to the king have been mentioned so far in the book. 7 eunuchs, 7 legal advisors, and a handful of other people. 18, and out of nowhere comes this guy, Haman. We know nothing about his background. And he's made, essentially, second in command. His position is basically the position of prime minister. He's the king's right-hand man. He's elevated, the text says, to a seat of honor, a throne above that of all the royal officials. So it's not just a cabinet position. Here, there is a kind of great centralization and concentration of power. If you're the king, it's easier to have one guy report to you than have 11. So he's got his guy. He's got one head on the horse. Right? And this makes it easier for the king to control things, I suppose. And we're given here a really critical piece of information. Haman, the son of Hammedatha, is an Agagite. This is an important part of the story, right? Agag was the king of the Amalekites back at the time of Saul. So that's like 500 years ago. And the Amalekites, 500 years before that, at the time of the Exodus, they sought to destroy and attack Israel in the wilderness. So this feud, if you will, this lineage of dealing with the Amalekites is 1,000 years old at this point. God promised Moses that he would erase the memory of the Amalekites and war against them from generation to generation. And in Deuteronomy 25, he commands Israel to war against them, to blot them out. Then 500 years later, Saul comes to power and Samuel tells him, you need to destroy the Amalekites and Agag, their king. It was to be a complete, total, holy war. And yet, Saul spared Agag. He spared the best sheep, too. He spared the best cattle. He did it in disobedience to the Lord. And because of this, Saul's abandoned and rejected as king of Israel. So, this long, bitter warfare with the Amalekites, centered around Agag, right, is evoked when Haman is called an Agagite, a descendant of King Agag. That means Haman's an Amalekite. And it's important to remember also at this point, we just noted it at the time, back in chapter 2, right? In Mordecai's genealogy, he's from the tribe and the house of Saul. Right? So this conflict between Saul and Agag is being revived here between Haman and Mordecai. So all the royal servants bow down. They pay honor to this Agagite, Haman. And they do so, the text says, because the king commanded it. Apparently they needed a law for that too. I command you to bow down to him. But Mordecai, and this is an act of civil disobedience, right? He refuses to kneel or pay honor. And the narrator, as usual, right? We should be used to this by now. The narrator gives us no comment as to why. It's not an idolatry or a worship issue, which you might be tempted to think, right? I don't think it is, because Jews can and Jews do bow down to rulers and others in Scripture on numerous occasions. When you do that in this culture, that's an act a lot like bowing one's head or standing when someone enters the room or kissing the hand of the queen. It's an act of courtesy. It's an act of court protocol. Right? It's public honor. It's not worship. That's not the issue here. Mordecai would have bowed to the king, or he wouldn't be an official in the Persian court. Right? The issue is almost surely the fact that Haman is an Agagite and Mordecai is from the house of Saul. And thus he sees Haman as a mortal enemy, an enemy of the people of God. Right? He probably grew up hearing about Saul's failures, and he doesn't want to make the same mistake. So he doesn't bow down. Day after day after day, the text makes it clear this is not one incident of civil disobedience. It happened every day. And the other officials asked Mordecai about it, right? Day after day, about his actions, but he refuses to comply. The text gives the impression that they're trying to, you know, encourage him to comply. Now, Haman apparently didn't even notice that among the throng, Mordecai wasn't complying. But that, by the way, tells you that Mordecai was probably not in the upper echelons of Persian officials. If this was a small group of people, it would have been visible right away. He's probably some mid-level official somewhere. Because Haman's walking by, everyone's bowing down, and he doesn't even notice that there's one guy who's not bowing down. In any event, eventually Mordecai's other officials, his colleagues, now clearly they're not hostile originally, but eventually they get irritated and they tell Haman. That's in verse 4. The text says to see whether this behavior, whether his words would stand, whether his behavior would be tolerated. Because the text tells us Mordecai had told them, he had told his colleagues, that he was a Jew. Now that should shock you if you're reading to this point. You're like, what? I mean, Esther can't tell anybody that she's a Jew? She gets coerced into this, you know, sexually oppressive situation, and she marries, she has to be quiet, but you can just tell people you're a Jew? It's strange. And again, I don't think this means I'm a Jew, I bow to God alone. It means I'm a Jew, I won't honor this Amalekite, this descendant of Agag. Now, the Persian Empire was known to be generally tolerant toward the many, many ethnic and religious groups under its umbrella. This, though, will become a new kind of test for the empire. Notice something else here. Mordecai has tactically chosen submission and conformity to this point. That's been his mode of operating. He felt no need to draw the line when his adopted daughter, Esther, was co-opted into a marriage with a pagan king. He insisted at that point that she hide her Jewishness to get along. And then he actively saved the regime by exposing the assassination plot. And now he chooses a completely different tactic of resistance. He reveals his Jewishness. He actively opposes the regime in this dangerous, public, provocative act. And by the way, one can question the wisdom of this action or the consistency of it. After all, the action provokes an attempted Holocaust. When you do something that provokes an attempted Holocaust, you might think, hey, I wonder, I mean, could I really, did I need to do that? I mean, think about this. All the later heroism in the book, from Mordecai and from Esther, everything, all of it, are just to undo the fruits of this one act. Like, there is a universe where Mordecai does bow down, shows court courtesy, and life goes on as it would have gone on. And there's no threat to the Jews at all. And there's no Feast of Purim, and Christ is born. But that's not the world we get. So Haman is an Agagite. Maybe Mordecai knows him and knows something about his very soon-to-be-revealed monstrous moral character this guy has. But still, I want to make this point. It is far from clear, especially in exile, outside of the theocracy, outside of the land, it is far from clear that he could not have shown mere civil honor or courtesy to an Amalekite in power. After all, Deuteronomy 25 says, when you enter the land and subdue the land and are at rest in the land, then you should take care of the Amalekites. But that's not the way Mordecai reads the history. This is the call he makes. But notice, it is a grand reversal of his previous strategy to fly under the radar. Right? Previously, he's just thinking, let me survive. Maybe I can accumulate some power and influence. So that's the refusal. Our second point is the rage. When Haman, he sees that Mordecai would not bow down or pay homage, he's filled with fury. You probably have many, many dozens of public officials, right? And they're all bowing down. But you're totally focused on the one guy. Like 99 people love your work, you have one critic, and you're obsessed with the critic. He's filled with fury. Vashti refused to come, and the king was enraged. And now the king's underlings have learned that rage is the mode of responding to personal slights. In both cases, by the way, you have this minor semi-public issue. It's turned into an empire-wide matter of law. So again, like disproportion, overreaction, excess, grand legal gestures in the face of petty local offenses. This is the way of the total state. Everybody owes all allegiance all the time. In the first case, right, Vashti's rebellion, the law said husbands rule their own households. The law was comic. Here the decree or the law is tragic. Haman learns, oh, Mordecai's a Jew. And that ancient hatred of the people of God, what we would now call anti-Semitism, completely overrules here, overrides this Persian practice of tolerance. This is quite unique. He scorns the idea, Mordecai does, as beneath his dignity of killing only that one guy who won't bow. I must kill everybody who's racially or ethnically connected to him. All Mordecai's people, we're told twice here in the text at this point that these are Mordecai's people. He becomes now identified with the Jews. We're going to kill them all throughout the whole kingdom. Now remember, this would include all the Jews in Palestine. They're part of the empire, not just the Jews in exile. And that means the Davidic line and the ancestors of Christ would be in the crosshairs. This is the hostility and the ancient hatred between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent that goes all the way back to Genesis 3. It's the only way to explain the irrationality of what's happening. So in the 12th year, verse 7 says, that is 5 years after Esther becomes the queen, in the first, she still hasn't revealed her Jewishness, 5 years in the palace. In the first month, the month of Nisan, Haman, he has some of these professional diviners cast lots to select the day and the month for the massacre of the Jews. So he's calling upon fortune or the gods, looking for a good day for mass slaughter. And the lot is called the Pur, or the Pur. In Hebrew, the plural is Purim, and that's the name for the Feast of Purim, right, which happens around March every year. The Jews dress up in costumes of their enemies, and they celebrate, and they sing, and they eat, and they give gifts to one another. It's derived from the events in this book. We're not told exactly how this lot casting process works, but they cast a bunch of lots. The lot fell to the 12th month, and later we're told the 13th day. That's a full 11 months away. We cast lots and said we're going to do this killing 11 months from now, which will, of course, allow time for the deliverance of the Jews to be conceived and to be executed. Even here, a careful reader notes the hand of the Lord of time, right? The Lord of the delay, the Lord of the interim, the Lord of the deferred decree. So Haman's got his date. Oddly, he does this first. Now he has to persuade Ahasuerus of the plan. He must be confident he can succeed, otherwise he would have got the king's approval before he drew lots for the date, which tells you something about this relationship. He knows he can get what he wants from this king, whether the king is, you know, lacks a certain spine or whether the king is a fool, I don't know. But who casts lots with a bunch of diviners to pick a day for a slaughter before you've even talked to the king about it? This guy does. So that tells you something about how he views the king's leadership and the king's moral discernment. And so you get this speech, right, to the king from Haman. It's a classic piece, this speech, of dehumanizing propaganda. Here's the speech. He begins like this. He says, there's a certain people. Now notice, the name of the people is suppressed. This way, the king can't put any faces to this people. Faces like the face of Mordecai the Jew, who's one of his officials. Or faces like Esther the queen, who's his wife. No faces. Keep the people anonymous. There's a certain people. It depersonalizes them. It turns them into abstractions. There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples. Well, that's true. Propagandists know how to use the truth. It's true, it's just given in a certain sinister way. They're scattered and dispersed among all the provinces, these people. They're ubiquitous. They're everywhere. They're rootless. And this stirs up a certain paranoia which flies in the face of Jewish weakness and impotence and political powerlessness. And it gives them a kind of mysterious power. This is part of the dynamic of how this works down to this day. So that's the truth, but it's a sinisterly told truth. And then the next thing he does is he tells a half-truth. He says, their laws and customs are different from those of every other people. Well, yeah, I mean, not totally. There's overlap between their laws and customs and other laws and customs. This implies here that they're separatists, that they're possibly anarchists of some kind. They're creating an alternative order with their own laws. And anti-Semitic writers have always looked at this, Jewish separation, Jewish unassimilation, as making them antisocial haters of humanity and the cause of all ills. Yes, they have their own laws and customs, but that's not the whole story, right? There are lots of ways to lie. Lots of ways to lie. You can lie by omission. You can lie by getting things out of order and proportion. They participate in Persian life. Mordecai works in the capital. For the most part, these Jews do what everybody else does. There's dozens of other religious people with their own rites scattered out throughout the empire as well. So he tells a truth in a sinister way, then he tells a half-truth, and then he tells a lie. The speech continues, and they do not obey the king's laws. That's an outright lie. There's one Jew who's disobeyed one court protocol, as far as we know. They do not obey the king's laws. So, what's the conclusion? You have a truth, a half-truth, then a lie. Here's the conclusion. It's not in the king's interest to tolerate them or to leave them alone. You know, you would think the king would say right here, what are you talking about? It's the empire's general policy to leave people alone. That's what we do. We're pretty tolerant. Right? This is an absurd claim that it's not in the king's interest to leave them alone. There's no evidence for it. But of course, this is about Haman's best interest and not the king's interest at all. So he proposes, this is in verse 9, he says, if it please the king, he proposes a decree to destroy the Jews. And without even waiting for the king to deliberate, he sweetens the idea with this bribe of 10,000 talents of silver, which is an absurd amount of money. A lot of scholars think it's just probably a satirical amount. They think it's near 65% of the empire's yearly revenue. There's no indication as to how Haman could possibly get that much money. It's unlikely that that represents his, you know, personal fortune, like he's some sort of, you know, plutocrat or something. Maybe he planned on taxing all the provinces and bringing the money into the king's treasury. We don't know. But the number is absurdly high. And that itself should have made Ahasuerus suspicious. But it's in the text, at least literally, to show how earnest he is about the genocidal plan. I mean, think about that. One person refuses to pay you public honor. And you decide, here's what we'll do. We'll kill him, we'll kill all the Jews, and we'll raise a bunch of money for the king doing it. So the king takes his signet ring and he gives it to Haman, sort of his seal, you know, who we're reminded again is an Agagite and thus the enemy of the Jews. Now, the king has, in this dialogue, he does this without so much as a follow-up question. He just takes his ring off and says, here. Like, there's no twinge of conscience. Do you realize that the king does not ask this guy for the identity of the people that are to be annihilated? He doesn't say, who are they? Which people are you talking about? He just hands over his ring, tells Haman to, it's ambiguous actually in the text what he says. He says something to Haman about the money. The money is given to you, or keep your money. It's not clear if the king's really accepting the money offer. But basically the idea is do with the people as you want to do. So this is delegation. It's delegation to the point of lunacy. And later we'll see this. The king actually forgets the whole thing. He forgets that it was something he authorized. Like, did I authorize a genocide? I can't remember. I can't really recall. So who knows? Maybe he was under the influence. For some reason, he doesn't know later on in the story that he even did this. That's the rage. The last point, the royal edict. The scribes are summoned, and they write out in the script and language of each people. Now notice, I want you to notice right here, because it's a recurring historical problem. Ordinary people, these scribes, they're just linguists, right? They're already complying with the madness, right? They're like, they're writing this out for all the provinces. You tend to want to skip all these ordinary people, but you're going to kill a bunch of people, right? You're going to enact a Holocaust. You're going to need the cooperation of lots of accountants and people who make the trains run and people who can translate and people who are going to look the other way. These scribes are already involved. They're complicit. They're caught up in the whole movement of the thing. All this being done on Haman's orders because he's now in charge. And this decree goes out. It goes through all the administrative and communication apparatus of the empire. Nobody stops it, as far as we can tell. The hand of fate is moving now with meticulous precision to this inevitable end of slaughter. Haman, not Mordecai, Haman is on the right side of history. One of the great inane phrases in our current politics, the right side of history, usually means something like, you agree with me. You're on the right side of history. And this decree that gets written, by the way, is even more vicious than what was said to the king. When he spoke to the king, he said, these people need to be destroyed. That's soft pedaling it. If you look at verse 13, the decree is to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all Jews. You can see the magnitude of the hatred. Young and old, women and children, get this, in one day. Don't know what would happen if the killing spilled over into a second day. Again, to do this, you have to enlist an army of ordinary people to become killers with an efficiency the Nazis would admire. Haman, the rabbis said, was worse than Pharaoh. One of the rabbis puts these words in Haman's mouth. Pharaoh was a fool for saying, every son that is born to you will be cast in the river. Did he not know that the daughters would marry and have children? I will not make such a mistake, but I will decree to annihilate and to kill and to destroy.
Right? The language of our text being put into Haman's mouth by a rabbi. And we learn at the end of verse 13, in addition, to plunder their goods. So if killing bothers you, please join us for the plunder afterwards. The deed itself is 11 months away. The decree is issued as law so that, the text tells us, that all the people, the whole murdering multitude, will be ready when the day comes. And what happens next? Well, the king and Haman sit down for a drink. The city, we're told, if you want a heartening note in this chapter, the city is bewildered or stirred up, and surely the other provinces were as well, by the decree, which indicates, of course, that not everyone, and probably not even the vast majority of people, were Jew haters. So, let me close with some things to remember about each of the points we made here tonight. First, on the refusal. We'll try and cast this out a little, right? It's important to see there's no one-size-fits-all set of tactics, right, for the rough and tumble world of politics and the world that Mordecai's in. He changes already in the first chapters from quiet submission to active support to open resistance. And by the way, as I said, he's arguably open to criticism at every point. Right? Wisdom and its practical application, which is prudence, right, requires great attention to the time, to the context, to the people we're dealing with. Ethics are, contrary to what you may have heard, situational. That doesn't mean we're relativists. God and his law are part of the situation. They govern the situation. What I mean when I say ethics are situational is simply this. The situation matters profoundly. And neither Daniel nor Joseph read their political situation or their options the way Mordecai and Esther read theirs. They just don't do that. You can't take Daniel's approach and apply it everywhere. So to insist that there's always a clear right and wrong answer on questions of strategy like this, tactics, in a broken world dominated by empire is a failure of maturity. And doing this well is exquisitely difficult, right? It's the work of discernment across a lifetime. And it's relevant for us. Why? Well, because we're resistors of a sort in an age of empire. And we'll disagree with one another, perhaps, on the right tactics here and there. And note this, history, like our narrator, does not tell us, or rarely tells us, if the choices we have made are indeed good and right choices. History never whispers in your ear, hey, you're on the right side of history. To live is to live with ambiguity. That's why we and our works are justified by faith. That's why we walk by faith and not by sight. So that's the refusal. Second is the rage. The text reminds us, and we saw this in the gospel lesson, right, from Jesus' own lips. Jesus expects his disciples to be hated. If they hated me, they'll hate you. If they persecuted me, they'll persecute you. There's this ancient, enduring, irrational, murderous hatred of God's covenant people loose in the world. This doesn't make us paranoid. It's just there. It's in fact divinely imposed, right? Genesis 3, God says, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. So don't be surprised by it. Expect it to endure. Jesus doesn't say, look, they're going to hate you guys for a little while, but then the gospel's going to go out, and eventually they're going to love you guys. He says, no, no servant is greater than his master. In general, the church has always been persecuted. Not always the same way, in the same time, but there are no places or eras where the church is free of persecution or hostility. So this lot-casting rage forgets, as Proverbs 16 says, that the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. There is a rage out there against the gospel. It's foolishness. But the rage of the nations is overruled by the Lord of the lot. In the New Testament lesson, right, the church gets together and they say this: Herod and Pontius Pilate met together with the Gentiles and the people of Israel to conspire against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed. And what did, to do what? What were Herod and Pontius Pilate doing? Well, the apostolic prayer continues. They did what your power and will had decided beforehand should happen. Right? And the Lord of the lot, his overruling, his delivering hand is seen in this text already. Already. Not just in the delay. You could see it there. But it's hinted at in the fact that the decree is issued on the day before Passover. Passover is the 13th of Nisan. This decree gets written on the 12th. The decree is issued and it starts to spread out as the Jews are getting ready to celebrate their deliverance from Pharaoh, the Pharaoh that Haman is trying to outdo. So under the hand of our God, the nations rage in vain because he's established his king in Zion, namely Christ, ironically, the crucified Jew as Lord. And finally, this royal decree. The empire, as we said before, is a parody. It's a parody of God, the universal judge, and his kingdom. And it issues this decree. But there's a decree against us more dreadful than this terrible decree. Right? It's the decree of God's curse. It's the decree of God's wrath against sin. His just wrath against the fallen race. And that decree against you and me has been born in the killing of Christ, the innocent Jew, the Passover lamb, the Jew whose line was saved from Haman. And thus, Christ the King, through his empire, through his holy Catholic Church, topples the kingdoms of this world, publishes abroad in every language and in every script and in every tribe and in every tongue the gospel of peace. Right, you have an alternative empire here in the Persian Empire with an alternative plethora of tongues and tribes and nations and an alternative false gospel and an alternative decree. We have a different empire with a different king and a different decree and a different publication. Namely, we publish the gospel of peace. We fear no decrees because in Jesus we face the worst decree. In fact, now we have the grandest of all decrees, the good news, from the Jews and to them first and then to the whole world to proclaim. We have a decree that gets sent out. And so you find in the book of Acts these fragile, empire-threatened early Christians praying in our New Testament reading. And we are to take their words on our lips. Now, Lord, consider their threats and enable your servants to speak your word with great boldness. And I might add, with great wisdom and tact and courage. Amen.